News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you're listening to the AM side at 1 o'clock, on the FM at 5 o'clock, or online at KMJNow.com. You know that each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want to honor them for their service, for the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories for posterity and along the way learn a thing or two. Today we're going to learn a whole lot, and you talk about sacrifices. Boy, are you in for a ride today when you hear about the journey of 93-year-old Richard Klemma of Porterville, California. I'm going to tell you how you can get his book, My Observations as a World War II POW, and how much of his life did he spend in captivity. We're going to find out, but let's start early on. You grew up in a town called Canopolis, Kansas. How big of a city was that?
Oh, about 800. Just a small town.
And before Pearl Harbor was ever on the consciousness of Americans, February of 1941, Uncle Sam said, "I want you." What do you remember about that?
Well, I was drafted in the second draft out of Ellsworth County. I went into the service in February 26th of 1941.
So you were 22 years old. What had you been planning to do with your life?
Oh, I was planning on getting a grocery business. I was looking for a location that I'd like.
And when you got drafted, they said, "We're going to take 1 year. You're going to serve in uniform for 1 year, right?"
Right. I had 10 months. I've been on maneuvers and got back to Fort Knox December the 6th, 1941. 2 months to do. December the 7th, war broke out. December the 8th, they said, "You're in for duration plus 1 year."
And who knows what that duration is going to be, and little did you know what you'd be in for. Let's talk about what kind of training you'd been through. You were in the 1st Armored Division.
Yes, the 6th Armored Infantry.
And you became a driver on a half track, right?
Right.
What was that like for people who don't know what a half track is? Give them the voice of experience as someone who drove them.
Well, it's a metal box on a truck frame and has tracks in the back and wheels in front. And in front of the wheels, there's a roller across the front where you hit something, it'll raise the front end up where the tires would catch on and push you on over. And in the back, there was seats on both sides, enough for four men on each side, but you're pretty crowded, and the driver and the sergeant. The tail lights was indented in the framework about 4 inches back, so they couldn't be seen from the air. You drove without lights on at night.
And you're preparing for desert warfare in North Africa. Did you know that at the time, that that's what they wanted to do with you?
Well, I thought that's what it was.
When December 7th did happen, and you hear, you're in for the duration, what did that do to your outlook, your mindset? Was that hard to deal with?
Well, I was perplexed. I didn't know what to think, but we was trained to go ahead and do everything that to protect ourselves.
When you heard all the reports and understood really what had happened at Pearl Harbor, did you have an emotional response to that? How did that motivate you?
Oh, everybody was really upset about it. And I don't know, I can't explain the feelings, but everybody was just hated that. And we didn't have much use for the Japanese then.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of you probably wanted to go to Japan and fight in that part of the world, not in Africa.
That's right. But it so happened that there's two fronts there. So.
And eventually, they would be sending you across the Atlantic to train in the United Kingdom. But that journey there was no picnic, I understand. And you're from a town of 800. I imagine the ship that you're crossing the Atlantic on was held a few more men than that.
There was 3,000 on it, and the ship was the SS Siboney, and They had accommodations for 1,500. So you had 12 hours above deck and 12 hours below deck. And I was lucky enough to have 12 hours above deck from 8 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning. That was no picnic there. You gone way up north there, and the wind was cold and the rain. One morning, just as I got all my down below deck, there was a loud bang. Boy, I went up to see what's going on, and there's three destroyers had a submarine cornered, shooting depth charges in on it. But outside that, it was not a bad trip over, but crowded.
And that gets your attention, I suppose, when you find out there are German subs in the area and you can feel the vibrations of these depth charges targeted at them. Was that kind of the first thing that you said, wow, this is for real, this is not a game?
Those waves were so high, the submarines couldn't go up there. So we felt fairly safe. But the ships had, every so minutes, had changed course. So we didn't have any problems after that.
And you made it across to Ireland, right?
We landed in Belfast, and our destination was Ardglass, pretty close to South Ireland's border.
And you'd have a lot more training there, preparing for some kind of invasion, right?
Doing a lot of training and building up our bodies and getting used to our weapons. And at that time, we went in with the old Springfield rifles, and then we got the M1s and target practice and different things.
And two 25-mile hikes a week?
At least two of them a week.
And what was that like for you? Did you think, boy, I don't know how much more my body can take?
You know, I got used to it, and it didn't bother at all. You take a 25-mile hike, and you get back, and you clean up, you'd be ready to go to town.
Now, if people have studied their World War II history, and a lot of the history we understand in broad strokes, and we hear the names of generals a lot more than the guys on the front lines. And one of the generals that people who know World War II have heard about is Mark Clark. Mark Clark came to inspect you guys, and, well, you ended up not feeling so good after a little incident there. Tell me about when you guys were cleaning your tanks and half tracks.
After the inspection, the captain says everybody's going to clean their half track like Strickland did. He used gas and oil to polish it up in and out. You can clean your motors and everything and shine them up. And I was shining my motor, and the points on the starter was about an inch and a half apart, and the brushes they give us had the metal bands on them about 2 inches wide, and I hit those, and it went up in flames. And the guy next to me grabbed his extinguisher and put it out, and all it did was singe my eyebrows and hair a little bit. When headquarters heard about it, they says, don't shine those things up, get mud and dirt and get all that stuff off. You'd be sitting ducks for the Germans.
Because from the air, you would stand out like a sore thumb if you were all shiny.
Right. But there's other things that happened there. That I had a date with a girl one night, and when I took her home, her mother was talking to me, and she says, don't you Americans believe in spirits? And I made a wise remark. I said, if they come in bottles. That was the wrong thing to say. And she says, my husband's seen leprechauns in such and such a building there. Then she talked a little bit, and she said, my husband heard those leprechauns in that building, you know. So I changed subjects real fast, like.
That incident where you singed your eyebrows, I mean, obviously you guys learned a lesson there, but when you look back on that now, do you feel like it could have been a whole lot worse?
Oh, yeah. All the half-tracks was lined up there, and it could have been 15 half-tracks burned up. My partner had a good sense of urgency. They put it out right away.
So you had a close call before you ever got into combat, but combat was coming. In late 1942, you were heading into North Africa. What did you expect as you're preparing for an invasion? Did you have any idea what you were getting into?
Well, being a driver, on the invasion, they could not use half tracks or vehicles at Oran on account of the terrain. So I wasn't there. But the battalion went in, and our company was on the lead boat. And there's two French warships there. And they spotted them coming in that early that morning, and they blew them out of the water. And we lost almost our whole company. According to my records, there's 7 men left out of about 130. And most of those was wounded that could not serve anymore.
And where were you while that was going on?
I was in England. When we went to England, they separated the drivers and the cooks and mechanics from the rest of the company.
What did that do to you when word came back to you and you found out what had happened to these guys that you had trained with, spent a lot of time with? How did you deal with that?
Well, it's just like you losing a family member.
And what did that tell you about your own future and what might be in store for you?
I just wondered whether I'd be buried in Africa or some other place. But the way things happened, I was real fortunate to come out without any real problems.
Well, you certainly went through a lot, and I want to hear about that. So you weren't in that initial invasion at Oran where all those heavy losses were suffered. When did you arrive in Africa?
We got there December the 15th, and that happened in November the 8th, 42.
When did you face your first combat situation?
After we got our replacements, we started for Tunisia. It took us about 4 or 5 days to meet up with the combat command. There were several things that happened on that trip. First day out, my squad was at a crossroads in the daytime, and we took over a little caravan of 3 camels and 2 little donkeys while we sent the Arabs back for interrogation. We had them there for most of the day, and the guys would tease those camels, and they'd either spit at them or bite at them, but he was glad that day was over.
I imagine you hadn't seen too many camels in Kansas.
Not very many. One night the whole company went out on a hilltop. You weren't supposed to light a match or smoke a cigarette or anything because that could be seen for miles. Well, the lieutenant says, gather up firewood. We build a great big bonfire. You could see it for 100 miles. That night, a little Arab boy about 8 or 9 years old come in there, and he had his big toe just about cut in half. And he got some embers and sealed that shut with those embers. I couldn't see. Boy, he had a lot of nerve. Another night, I run into a little log tree laying across there. Wasn't real big, but we jumped it, and I hit something on the other side. There's an Arab out there going, poor Billy, poor Billy, poor Billy. We hit his billy goat, we killed it. When we got back to our bivouac area, we had a sack of dates hooked on our bumper.
That's what the billy goat was carrying, huh?
Next day, we met up with the combat command, and they just fired at Fade Pass. They were shooting back and forth, and not doing a whole lot, but shooting at each other. When we come in late that afternoon or evening already, they says, you got to break through. Who did they say to break through? Our company with all the replacements.
So you guys became the tip of the spear there.
Yeah, our platoon was leading. The shells was firing. There's tracer bullets. You could see them look like a bunch of butterflies or lightning bugs or something. We got way up there, got into a deep ravine where the road went through, and the lieutenant's track hit a landmine, and we piled up there. Says, pile out, everybody.
You were in a half track right behind the lieutenant's half track, right?
I said, the second one back. There were 3 of us. And the rest of them stopped way back there because the heavy shelling.
But when the lieutenant hit the landmine, you couldn't avoid getting stuck right behind him, so you were kind of trapped, right?
Right. We didn't have no place to go. We got down that ravine and got ready to fight our way out, and the lieutenant says, "Count off." That's number 22. I was the last one to count off. He says, "We don't have manpower enough to fight our way out, so come out with your hands up."
When you heard that, I mean, I don't know how much time you had to think about it, but when you heard him say that, what did that mean to you? How did you feel about that?
We had Germans all around us, and I don't know if I had any feelings at all.
There were only 22 of you. And what are you armed with?
M1 rifles.
That's it. Nothing bigger than an M1 rifle.
No.
And these are Germans who have all kinds of artillery probably at their disposal, right?
188 sitting there that I seen. But most of them, I think, had rifles of some kind. But this German commander that we surrendered to that night says, "As soon as Roosevelt and Churchill wins this war, I'm going to beat you guys back to the States." He said, "I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania." Well, you got to think about it. Germany, when it's preparing for war, had a good economy, and the rest of the world was in a depression. So a lot of them, I shouldn't say a lot of them, some of them went over there to work. And when the war broke out, they were stuck.
What's your gut feeling on that? You think he made it back to the States?
I have no idea, because after that, it wasn't long. The war in Africa was over with.
And for you, it was over right then and there. When you look back on that now, maybe this sounds crazy, but do you think it was a blessing to be captured then and there the way you were? Do you think something worse could have happened to you if you kept fighting?
I think the good Lord had a reason for me not to be killed or hurt there, because as time goes along, after I got talking to different schools and school kids and the impressions that they give me, I figured maybe that's what it was. I don't know, but that's a blessing to me. That's what keeps me going.
And you are still going strong at 93, nearly 70 years after you were captured in North Africa. This program will keep going after this. We'll find out about Richard Klemma's experience as a prisoner of war in 3 different German POW camps. I'll also tell you about some upcoming events I think you're going to be interested in. If you would like to order Richard's book detailing his experiences, I've got all that information on our website at kmjnow.com. You can call this phone number, 559-361-3422. That's 361-3422. And again, I have that for you at kmjnow.com. Back to the interview with Porterville's Richard Klemma when Hometown Heroes continues after a brief word from our sponsors like Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school.
Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue with 93-year-old ex-prisoner of war Richard Klemma in a moment. But first, I want to tell you about a few upcoming events. Sunday, May 6th. That's Sunday, May 6th at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. It's the 17th annual Strawberry Waffle Brunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. You get great food and you get access to all those great warbirds for one low price. On Saturday, May 19th, you'll have a chance to come out and meet the veterans featured on Hometown Heroes that week. I will be out live at Carrington Point on Cedar and Alluvial in Fresno. That's on May 19th, and you'll be hearing more about it. And on the next day, May 20th at 2 p.m., the Sounds of Freedom Military Band will have a free Armed Forces Day concert at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. Okay, now let's get back to the night of February 1st, 1943. That's when our guest Richard Klemma was captured in North Africa by German forces. And at the time, you have no idea how long this war is going to go on. You don't know if it's going to be weeks or months or years. How did you deal with that uncertainty?
Well, you just live from day to day. One day is just like the other one. It was like yesterday was. It'll be the same thing tomorrow.
You know, I've had a lot of prisoners of war on this program, whether they were in the Pacific or in Europe. I don't know if I've ever had one captured in North Africa before. Most people think of the German POW camps, and they think of airmen shot down over Germany, or maybe some of the infantrymen who were surrendered en masse at the start of the Battle of the Bulge. But for you to be captured in North Africa, you had a few journeys ahead of you. What did the Germans do to you, and were you scared? I can't imagine not being scared in that situation.
We didn't know what had happened. The next morning, they loaded us in a truck and took us to Tunis. And on the Tunisian highway, the Germans had so many vehicles going each way, it was just about bumper to bumper. And I couldn't imagine them having that much equipment there. And when we went by the airport, they had big planes unloading tanks and personnel and all kinds of things. And then it dawned on me that it wasn't going to be very easy anymore.
We have the benefit of history now. We know what happened. But at the time, when you're seeing all this German firepower, did you wonder if it was possible to beat them? Did you think that the Nazis might win the war?
Well, always had a positive attitude, but you know, you always had doubts. They kept us there about 10 days in Tunis. They give us one little beans, about three times as big as a kidney bean. We started breaking them open, and then the kidney, there was a little black bug. So we quit breaking them open because we figured that's protein. Mm-hmm. We got about three or four of them once a day.
And at the time, you weighed about 165 pounds or so?
Yeah. We was there about 10 days. Then they put us in little junker planes, put about six or seven men in a plane.
And the junker is not a label that it was downtrodden, but that was the make, the junker JU-88s, right?
I think that's what my record shows. Anyhow, they flew us to Naples, but they flew just over a treetop, about maybe 100 or 150 feet off the ground. So fighter planes went and attacked them. They refueled in Palermo, took us on to Naples.
Did you fear that Allied forces might shoot you down?
Well, they flew so low over this territory, I don't think that, I didn't have no thoughts about that. But we were so getting so weak and tired, one thing didn't bother you anymore. and got to Naples. I think we were the first ones there in Naples. They didn't give us hardly anything to eat, losing weight and getting down farther and farther. And one time a little dog come in the compound, and we coaxed him, and he was being real friendly, you know. But you take a step towards him, you take two back. So we made a run for him. But he knew exactly where to hit that fence to get through.
And you weren't looking for a pet. You were looking for dinner.
That's right.
Obviously, it's a desperate situation. And you had no idea how much longer you were going to be dealing with being a prisoner. But what kept you going? What kept you from just giving up?
You always look at the bright side. You just knew you had to keep going. You either kept going or the alternative was you just did. But one thing I will say, I seen them train these little kids with tree limbs and things there in Naples. And we was there, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. They got more prisoners in, and they loaded us in boxcars called 40 or 8, 40 men or 8 horses. They put 72 of us in the boxcar. So you didn't have any room to move around. Yeah, that was rough.
What if you had to relieve yourself?
One of the guys had a knife, and he cut a hole in one of those doors, and they pulled some paper off the wall and tried to make a funnel there. But if you was close to him, you had to be careful. And then they'd gone to the Brenner Pass. They stopped and let us out for couple hours to let military trains go through. But you couldn't go any place because Italy was on one side, Switzerland, and then Germany and Austria. But you got a little bit of exercise anyhow.
And they would take you on to Moosburg, Germany, in Stalag 7A, where you would experience a relatively short stay. But it was enough to produce something worthy of putting on the cover of your book.
They took a little picture of me with their number.
I'll make sure that picture's on our website at kmjnow.com. This is basically your Nazi mugshot. The Germans are showing that you're their prisoner, and this is your number, and that's going to be your identity for a while.
That's right. I don't remember how I got it home or anything, but I do have it.
And it would come in handy later, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. What was life like there at Stalag 7A, and how much weight were you losing?
Going down and getting weaker and weaker. I was there a short time, maybe 10, 12 days. They loaded us in boxcars again and took us to Stalag 3B at Fürstenberg on the Oder, which is real close to Berlin. I was there for about 2 years.
But I imagine if someone told you the day you arrived at Stalag 3B, that you were going to be there for 2 years, you would have said, holy cow, how am I going to survive that?
That's it. You know, yesterday be like tomorrow will be, or today is, and you just did it from day to day.
And was Stalag 3B where you got your first taste of a Red Cross parcel?
Yes, but that was about a year and a half after we got there.
Boy, that's a long wait. In the meantime, what did they feed you? Did you get some of that famous German bread there?
Yes, that sawdust bread.
Tree flour.
We got a fifth of a loaf of it a day and a can of rutabaga soup.
How hard was it to cut that bread, and did you break any bones trying to do so?
Well, you just managed. That's all.
And I know in your book, you have the recipe for that bread in the back, but there's also a note that sometimes you found some strange ingredients baked in there.
That's right. You didn't know what you'd get.
One of the things that always amazes me when I talk to prisoners of war, especially guys who were in for a long time, the things that they came up with, the ingenuity, the things that they made out of stuff you didn't think they could. And, you know, we think of Gilligan's Island and the professor and what he did, or more recently, MacGyver and the stuff that he could concoct. But I think the inspiration was UPOWs in World War II. How did you cook? Where did you come up with a makeshift stove?
Well, that's after we got Red Cross parcels. If there was an empty bunk, they'd get the slats of the boards out, get cans, and make burners out of them. They'd put two cans, one can on top of another. The bottom can is where they put the fire. Your margarine and crackers come in round cans, and they'd make blowers out of them. And where they got the wire, I don't know. They probably cut it off the fence someplace.
They would bend pieces of the can into like a fan, basically?
And then they'd get some little timbers or something, light them and turn it, and it'd really cook in a hurry. Then some of them was electricians, and they'd make a little cans to heat water and different things. Some of them got to making crystal radio sets.
And those would come in real handy because the Germans certainly weren't telling you the truth of what was going on, I'm sure.
Well, they always take something and make it to look like they was winning.
But with those radios that some of the guys were able to craft out of bits and pieces of Red Cross parcels, you guys were able to pick up the BBC, right?
Well, yeah, but that was later, about the time that they invaded Europe and France. Under one of the bunks, these bunks was two wide, two deep, and three high. And back in the corner, they took boards out of one of them and dug a hole there. It was all sand, and they made sure that no fresh sand was shown. And they got hold of a console radio and put it down there. They'd give us BBC news every night. The Germans found out that we had a radio, but they never did find it.
And it wasn't that they didn't try to find it, right?
I don't know. As time went on, you could tell by their attitudes how the war was going. First, when we was there, every morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, we was out there for roll call. Then it got to the point where they just come through. And
I read in your book that there were times if someone had disappeared for a day or two or made his way out of the camp somehow, that you guys had a neat way of covering for him and making sure the Germans couldn't get an accurate count. How'd you do that?
Some of the guys, some of the Germans count them, they crawl back and go up to the other end there, force their way in.
So they'd keep moving around in the line, so the count kept getting thrown off.
Yeah, right.
And the Germans would eventually just give up?
Well, they'd say they're all there.
Did you ever contemplate trying to escape?
No, I was a little leery about it because they had security zones, and you'd have to know how to get through those. I couldn't speak German. Figured I'd be better off just to wait it out.
How did you pass the time and keep from going crazy or giving up? Because some guys did.
Some of us would just argue about some silly things, like does shaving cream soften your beard or toughen it, and things like that. Or if a tree fell down and nobody seen it, did it make a noise? Just different things.
Did you at any point have any contact with your family back home?
Oh, yeah. They let us write to a week after a period of time. You had to be careful what you said, and they wasn't big enough you could say very much.
This is the V-mail that people are familiar with. Yeah. So you were sending that home. How often did you actually get some kind of news from home?
Well, the folks would write on and off. My sisters would write. And we knew that they knew that we was alive.
You're one of four brothers that would end up serving in the military. And one of them decided to go into the Army at age 17 because he wanted to try to go out and find you?
That's what he said, yeah. He didn't have to go in if he didn't want to, but he figured he would go in.
Did you find out about that while you were a prisoner or not till after the war?
After the war. I got out and he was still in.
What did that mean to you that your brother would care that much that he would put his own life on the line when he didn't need to try to save yours?
Well, it makes you feel like your family, you're closer. It's just like the ones in your outfit. You just felt so close to them. They was just family to you.
And I'm sure in captivity, it really felt like family. And I know that the American Ex-Prisoners of War organization has a motto that just about every POW I've ever interviewed has shared with me, that we help those who cannot help themselves. How did you see that playing out in the prison camp? What were some of the things that you saw that stick with you even now?
Well, the camaraderie of everybody. We was all for one for all, the way I'd say it. That's as close as I can come to it. But
do you look back at your time in captivity and see circumstances, whether it be people or a well-timed Red Cross parcel or some other meal or stroke of good fortune, and you say, you know what, that saved my life? Can you point to instances like that that still stand out for you?
Yes. As soon as we started getting them, some of the guys started writing in and saying to take out money of their allotments for the Red Cross. And the Department of Defense wrote back, says, that's all well and good. You can do it if you want to. But the Army is paying for all these things, sending them through the Red Cross.
Do you think you would have survived without that, without the little food that you got, even though it wasn't much? That do you think you would have made it without the Red Cross?
That's something I could have to debate on that, because, you know, I lost almost half of my weight and go on another 6 or 8 months that we got them. I don't know if I could survive or not.
Well, we are all so glad you did survive and that you're telling us about it today, and that there's more to come. The rest of Richard Klemma's story when we come back. Go to KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and more information. And don't go anywhere else, because Hometown Heroes will be right back after we hear from our sponsors, starting with my good friends at Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it, they have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Richard Klemma. He's 93 years old, lives in Porterville, California now. Captured in North Africa on the first day of February 1943, he remained a prisoner of war until April of 1945. He went from a healthy 165 pounds to right around 100, never knowing how long his torturous ordeal might last. His liberation would eventually come at Stalag 3A in Luchenwald, a brutal camp where more than 5,000 prisoners had died during the war due to starvation, disease, or, as we'll hear, brutality and cruelty. But most of Richard's captivity was spent at Stalag 3B in Fürstenberg Oder. That's where he was when we left off, and at this camp, you Americans were segregated from other prisoners, like the Russians, right?
Yeah, but the Russians was the next fence over, and the fences was 5 feet apart. If you could talk to them, then you could talk back and forth.
And there was something I read in your book that really stood out to me, and I think for most people, just reading that word is a little bit shocking. But obviously, it's a desperate situation for all of you. And you heard that what was going on in the Russian compound had gotten really desperate, that they had resorted to cannibalism?
That's what the Germans told us. So I got to go by their word. After we got Red Cross parcels, we started giving them our rutabaga soup. And the Russians warned us, as if you give them too much, they'll eat so much they'll explode.
When you think back on it, what was the most difficult aspect of being a prisoner of war? What was the hardest thing to face every day, the hardest thing to survive?
First thing, that the lieutenant told us to come with our hands up. I'd been one that, let's fight it out. And we didn't have no choice. If the rest of the combat command had been there, it had been another story, but they weren't.
And believe it or not, Stalag 3B was not the last prison camp that you experienced in World War II. When and why did they take you out of there?
Well, when the Russians got close to across Poland, close to Germany, one afternoon they told us to pack up everything we want to take with us and leave.
Was that exciting for you, or was that a little scary?
I was perplexed by it. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know whether we could trust the Russians or we could trust the Germans or what.
What was the weather like right about then?
Well, it was the coldest winter on record. The first night out, they put us up in a dairy farm. The next night, they went through a security zone. An SS trooper would take us through, and the guys that relieve themselves or something, go back in the bushes or out there, and he'd go through there yelling. He had a voice you could hear halfway across the ocean, and he'd wave his 45 in the air, and the guys would be running with their pants down, and the dog come out, and he shot the dog.
Well, and I'm sure after surviving as much as you had survived, you didn't want to be shot by a German when maybe you can sense the end is getting closer, huh?
Right. One night they put us up in a pig farm. About 10 of us chased these pigs out of a shed to get out of the cold and the wind. You didn't get a lot of sleep because the pigs would stand in the doorway and oink all night long, but they wouldn't come in.
Had you ever experienced that degree of cold before? I mean, that sounds like, and especially when you're having wasted away from starving for all these months.
The only place that I was real cold was at Rock Hill, South Carolina in December 41.
But you were a free man then, and you had all your body weight.
That's right, and we had clothing and all kinds of comfort items.
And you mentioned clothing, and maybe some people instinctively know this, but for all the time you were a prisoner of war, did you ever have a change of clothes? Did you ever get new clothes, or were you wearing the same exact articles for that entire duration?
The same ones. You wore the same ones. If you tried to wash them, you'd be out in the cold for a while. Another thing that happened is when we was being evacuated, we went across the an overpass where they building a road. I don't know if you ever seen these old farm wagons that they used to haul grain in with the big wooden wheels. They had several of those in there with either dirt or cement or something, building roads, and had these Jewish men working on them, and they was a lot thinner than we were. And of course, I just got a glimpse of it from going over the overpass, but I did see about three of those wagons out there. I don't know how many of those Jewish people were there.
And at the time, you had no idea the extent of what Hitler and his regime had done to the Jewish people.
No, but we soon to find out at Stalag 3A.
And this is where they marched you to from Stalag 3B.
Right, at Luchenwald. We started looking around, and we went through this one building that where they did put the Jews. And I don't know how wide it was. I don't remember anymore. First thing you seen, the floor was sloping to the center, and there's a trough running from one end out in the field there. There's a little compartment about 4 foot wide. Up in the corner was a little window about 18 inches square, way up in the corner. And the wall was from floor to ceiling, and along the wall on both sides, there's a ditch right to the one in the center there. The steel door could only be opened from the outside, and the floor was just a little bit sloping. The odor in it was terrific. You just can't imagine how they would put people like that.
I can tell you could still feel that oppressive evil even in just the aftermath of the atrocities that had been committed there. And you weren't done living life as a prisoner. How long was it until you finally tasted freedom again, and what did that feel like?
It wasn't too long, and the Russians came in early one morning, and there's a lot of noise going out, and got out to see what's going on, and here the Russians' vehicles was there. They tore the fences down and everything, and it was kind of curious how the Russians would treat us. It wasn't long. American convoy come in. There's only 15 miles from us. The story is that English colonel had the other nationalities load in to these trucks, except the last two on the back have Americans, because they're afraid that the Russians would keep these other people prisoners. As they went out of camp, the Russians fired over them and made them come back. So the next day, my buddy and I was out walking. All I had on was shirt and pants and shoes, and that's about all I had. And the convoy come in, and four of us got on that bumper of that Jeep. There's either 12 or 14 other guys piled in. The driver just says, "Give me enough room so I can see." We didn't know whether it was getting out or not. But after we got through Magdeburg, Germany, we knew we was out. And they put us up for the night, give us warm blankets and stuff. And next day they flew us to Reims, France.
Well, I've got to ask you, talk about them giving you a place to sleep and giving you warm blankets. I bet that's the best you slept in a long time. What did it feel like to actually go to bed knowing that you're a free man again?
That's like heaven to us, because up to that time, it was either freezing or burning with heat.
And starving the whole time.
Right. And at Reims, I was supposed to be there 3 days, and they give us an SS trooper to do our chores for us. We wanted water, or they had to get it for us, or whatever. I was there half a day, and got a chance to get on a truck, go to Havre, France. That was an eye-opener for me, because they had these bunkers in there. The walls on them was probably a yard thick, it looked like to me, with little cubby holes on three sides for them to shoot out of. And they'd be busted up, and these gun barrels laying all over the beach. And as soon as we got there, they separated us by state. I got on a boat June the 1st of 45.
And all these POWs on the ship were all from Kansas.
Right. I think we got some clothes there, too. Went to town and bought a new pair of shoes. Put my old ones in the box and put them in underneath the seat in the theater. Walked out with new shoes.
And so many veterans, whether they're prisoners or not, even guys who maybe just served a brief time in the service but got to come back into the States through New York Harbor, all seem to mention the same thing. And I know this was powerful for you too. After being a prisoner for so long, finally getting back to the United States, and the first glimpse you see is Lady Liberty extending that torch. What kind of symbolic value did that hold for you?
When we come into the harbor, I see the Statue of Liberty. It's so emotional, you ought to kiss the ground. And I can't explain it any more than that. It's a feeling that's hard to explain. You knew you was free, and you was home again. The country that you love.
And you would get back to Kansas. What did it feel like to see your family again? What do you remember about that?
Well, my little sister's grown up, and my mother and dad was older, and there wasn't nobody there my age. They was all in the service or gone, and it was just like he was in another world.
When you were back in the States, did you take less for granted after learning what it was like to not have freedom? Did it change your outlook, do you think?
Oh, yeah. If you see how those people lived, well, I'll put it this way. At 3B, the path to town was by our back fence. The older canal was maybe a fourth of a block over. These people, these mostly women, would come by, and the guys would talk to them. They had a pretty good life if they weren't at war, but they didn't want the war. When we got Red Cross parcels, they seen that we had candy bars in them and cigarettes. You know, that made a big difference on them. But I just don't know how to explain it, but you appreciate what you have.
One thing you thought you had was an unquestioned record of service, but like many veterans, your records were burned in a big fire in St. Louis. So after more than 2 years fighting for survival as a POW, you still had to prove you had actually done anything in uniform. So in order for the military to actually grant you veterans benefits, you were able to dig up that old POW mugshot and the dog tags the Germans had issued you. That story is detailed in your book. One thing you've had the chance to do in recent years is to take an honor flight back to Washington, D.C. and see the World War II Memorial. What was that like for you, to see that your generation was recognized in such a powerful and visible way in our nation's capital?
Just tells me that the country was honoring us for what we did. It gets into your heart that you appreciate it and you love it.
And when you go around and you give these presentations to schools and these young people ask you all these questions and they want to know why, and they want to know why it matters and why we should care today about World War II, what do you tell them?
Well, most of them don't ask those questions. Well,
what do you want them to know?
Well, there's a better way of living than this world's gone on now. And it's up to them to change it.
I know almost 94 years is a lot to think about what you're thankful for. But when you look back on what you've been through and how incredible it is that you even survived everything that you've been through, what are you most thankful for?
I'm most thankful for my family and the country I live in and being able to live here. Did you ever see little kids going through garbage cans looking for food or not knowing where their next meal's coming from or even older people done it.
And I'm sure people have asked you, and I've asked you kind of this question already, how you did it, how you survived, how you got through. Who deserves the credit for that? What do you give the credit to?
The good Lord wanted me to do it. That's all. Because there's no way I could have done it other way.
Well, I know we've had a long conversation here, but I want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything else that you want us to know?
The people of this country should know what it was like, because some of them think that it was all potatoes and gravy for us.
It was more rutabagas and sawdust bread, huh?
Right.
So if we've got some history teachers out there who want to bring in a living, breathing example of World War II and what it was like to be a prisoner of war, you're willing to go talk to these guys?
Sure. All they got to do is call my daughter. She will come.
Good idea. And that's how they can get their hands on your book, too. It's called My Observations as a World War II POW. You can call Mr. Clemma's daughter, Nancy, at 559-361-3422. That's 361-3422. All that information is online at kmjnow.com. We're out of time for today, but please join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.